I'm kind of assuming you all know me, but I guess I should introduce myself. My name is Tuere Salah. For those of you that are normal Thursday night people, you might be thinking, who are all these other people on this call? But we opened up this evening so that we could support people who wanted to talk about the election. And since we're talking about equanimity, this is a great time to talk about it. And Carrie's here with me, and Carrie and I are going to offer the teachings this evening. I'm going to talk a little bit, and then Carrie's going to talk. Then we'll do our usual, get some tea, and we'll come back and then open it up to the space to see what's alive for all of you. I'll just leave Carrie, I'll just leave it for you to introduce yourself when you do your share, okay? So Joy Harjo in this poem, in case you don't like read through the imagery, she speaks in imagery a lot. And this whole poem, when she's talking about being in the winter, she's talking about being in a world where there's a lot of suffering, a lot of difficulty. She calls that the winter time. So you can see in her poem all these different aspects of drawing out winter, because in truth, suffering comes in many different ways. It's not like there's just one kind of suffering, it's all different kinds. I notice how, I'll just be going along feeling fine, and then I'll get a thought, and then I'll have all this difficulty, and then I pull myself back, and then going along, and then another thought, a different thought. And it's just very different, suffering is. And yet, we live in a world of samsara. So suffering is an inherent part of the world we live in. And for those of us that are practitioners, we're kind of displaced. We're possessed because we live in this world of samsara, but our practice is trying to help us live free of that, somehow in it and not in it at the same time, which is very difficult to do. But this is the kind of thing that we've taken on. So, a lot of our suffering is in this area of aversion and pain and isolation and all of that. And then she uses spring to talk about freedom, to talk about a hope and possibility, and talk about just the interconnectedness, laughter, the being together, the way we are here. This is like springtime. It feels like winter when we're away from each other, and springtime when we come together and feel and get to know this connection with each other. So, her sense of grace, she gave a little bit of these things I'm sharing you. She's the one that said that she speaks of winter as suffering and spring as connection and interconnection with people. And her use of the word grace in this kind of way for us as practitioners, it would be stillness, stillness and peace and practice, the gift of our refuge that we take. And she uses grace as this kind of liberation, somehow looking for liberation. But what I love about this poem, what I love, 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 love about this poem is the ordinariness of the way she talks about this. So the ordinariness of you making a choice to come on this call, and all of a sudden we are together. It's so ordinary, and yet it's so powerful and It's such a gift to be together and know we are not alone. And yet it's so ordinary to just click on Zoom nowadays. Just click on Zoom. This is like our truck stop with some pancakes. And all of a sudden we're kind of sitting around saying, "Oh, I think my nervous system is beginning to like settle down a little bit. I think I can. I'm got my peeps with me. I'm feeling a little bit okay." That sense of ordinariness and grace, that felt sense, is what we have to keep encouraging each other with. And so it was our good fortune that we happened to be in equanimity. And I can't believe it. I didn't think I was going to have to lean on equanimity quite as much as I do, but we do. And so thankfully, we're going to practice with equanimity this month and begin to see what equanimity is. So I'm only going to talk about 5 more minutes and then I'm going to turn it over to Carrie, but just having a sense in equanimity that our understanding of equanimity is not the dictionary view. This is what I think is most important. When we look at equanimity in the dictionary, it looks very bland, very humdrum and kind of, unperturbed. I don't care. It's kind of like a, like things just roll off of us the way, nice new polish on your car and the water just beads on it and rolls off. Doesn't even sink in. But equanimity in Dhamma is a little different. It is set in motion by the heart. So it is this unshakable mind. It is a unshakable energy. So it is a fierce energy. And it means it's not that you don't have emotion or discomfort or difficulty or whatever arises within the world of samsara and suffering. But this notion that we would know that grace exists because we've seen it, is this unshakable capacity towards liberation. This is what equanimity is in the heart. It is this unshakable knowing towards liberation. And it arises out of our practice. So in the paramis, it arises at the culmination of 10 paramis. This is the 10th of the paramis. In the 7 factors of awakening, it arises out of that balancing. It's the 7th of the factors. It's this quality of beginning to come, I think as Gil Fronstal says, like standing in the middle of it. So it's not standing in the middle and everything is all peaceful and I'm peaceful and you're peaceful. It's all peaceful. It's not that. It's having this ability to stand in the middle, even when things are difficult, so that you don't topple over. You're like firmly rooted in the ground. You're balanced in your stance. So even if you were going to do a yoga pose that's difficult to do, there's a balancing that you begin to cultivate so that you have a center core that's solid. And this equanimity from the heart space, it comes from our inner core. This is what it is. And the more we touch into and connect to and cultivate the strength of that inner core, then our ability to be in wicked weather, difficult torrent stressful times, we can do it from the core out and not necessarily needing conditions to be our way. Because in truth, it really didn't matter how this election was going to turn out. We were all going to still be practicing today. We are going to be practicing tomorrow. We were going to be practicing until we die, regardless of what happens. It would have been nicer to practice with a little more ease, true enough. But when we get together like this, we can remember we're going to practice regardless. We're always going to have difficult days ahead of us. Always going to have disappointment and stress and problems and challenges. So this practice is just a way for us to remind each other what we may have forgotten because of the shock of what happened. So we're just reminding each other we were always going to be here in some difficult situation, trying to support each other. So I'll leave it there so Carrie has plenty of time. And we are so happy, Carrie, that you are here with us. We thought we would do this together. And then, I'll just pass it to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tori. And just want to say I feel very grateful that you all, the Thursday night Sangha, let all of us crash the party in a way. So I appreciate you being willing to expand your Sangha. I feel like at the deepest level, we're all one Sangha. And yet we have our rituals of gathering that look a certain way. So anyway, I appreciate your willingness to widen for tonight. And I feel very glad to be here. Just a little infusion of joy listening to Tori talk, and I haven't felt that in a few days, so appreciating the joy infusion as well. When we gather like this, I was speaking to somebody about this today who comes from a different tradition, and she was saying that in her tradition, when people go through intensity or difficulty collectively or personally, there are a number of rituals that they come together and practice. So the point is the coming together, but there are rituals that hold the intensity of the energy as they're gathering. And I was thinking about that tonight, because although there's a lot of our tradition, as most of us or many of us practice it now, that is kind of stripped down of certain rituals. But it is a ritual, kind of like Tori was saying about the truck stop. We sit down, we open the computer, we arrange ourselves, we position our body in a certain way. We look out, we remember other people, we hear the bell, we incline our minds in a direction, and there's a ritual around that. You know? And that repetition is very important, it's very potent. So that ritual is what's meant to help us remember. These are the times that we practice for. We talk a lot about practice, 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 practice. And it's been so striking to me over the past few days that it is moments like this that we practice for. Not so we'll have a perfect response Right? Or be perfectly balanced, attuned, and peaceful when things unfold much differently than we expect. But that we will know a direction for refuge. Where, in what direction is there a possibility for refuge, for true trust and letting go for my heart? So we practice so that in these moments we will remember that direction and that possibility. I'm sensitive to kind of how much language to offer right now. How many people over the last few days have almost felt like taking in a lot of words or information is too much? Anybody felt like that? Like too much? Yeah. So I was with a group of people teaching on Tuesday night during the election, and I was under the impression that we weren't going to know until much later the results of the election. And so I was working with uncertainty and a lot of fluctuating feelings and unknown. And many of the people more tuned in than I was clearly knew that things were going in a direction that they didn't expect. And I walked into that gathering, and there was such a feeling of heart and connectedness and sangha. And there was also a feeling that almost like to say anything was a bit too much, almost. So we do need to say things, we need to express, we need to be together in all of our in all of it. But it's been over the last few days such a kind of exquisite, palpable sense of sensitivity, right, to the quivering and the fluctuations of our hearts, and to almost try to insist or steer that or make that different in any way. Almost feels like too much. And maybe we're at a different point now. But the promise of practice and the promise of this quality of equanimity that this unshakable quality that Tuari was mentioning, it's that possibility that allows us in the moment when it might feel like the rug is pulled out or something that we had been pointing towards evaporates, or in the moment when we get the diagnosis unexpectedly, right? Or the deep disappointment or loss, these different expressions of dukkha. It's those moments that I think as practitioners, we can sense there's a possibility there. There's a possibility for openness and actually for deepening. Yeah, there's the potential that practice in those moments deepens. Right? So I've been feeling that so strongly in the last few days. the potential for a deepening sense of refuge, a deepening sense of commitment to one another, and just in these moments, again, I think of them as rug kind of being pulled out. I didn't feel as though I had a lot of strong expectations going into this election, the sense that, it was absolutely going to go one way or the other. But in those moments of when reality sort of shifts, reality that we, the way we think things are going, just shifts suddenly. There's a gap there, right? There's a gap there. So we don't need to insist on peace or insist on a certain reaction, but in that gap, maybe we can feel. I'm thinking of somebody offered last a couple of nights ago the poem from Pablo Neruda when I will count to 12 and just for a moment, let's not move our arms so much. Maybe we'll be together. We can then be together in a sudden strangeness. So, in this moment where our sense of reality might be shifting and we're adjusting, we're digesting, we're absorbing. But as that sense of reality shifts, there can be, instead of the machinery and the concocting of our conceptual mind that immediately wants to come forward with blame or with a plan or with how did this happen or who can I find fault or can I go back over and find exactly what went wrong in just in that gap before that gets going or what about this scenario or what about that scenario there are very real dangers ahead. It very well, things could very well get more and more challenging on many levels. And this is why we practice. We have all been cultivating in certain ways so that we will be able to be available to one another in moments like this. In moments like this, so that we have a sense of direction and refuge, so that we can be in that gap where reality shifts and reorients, and we can just let it do that, can let it do that, and hopefully sense the potential in that. It's okay for it to be disorienting. So oftentimes people will say, "Oh, equanimity, I need more of that. I need to get that. I need to get more peace." Equanimity is a process of letting go of all of our contention with experience. And that process becomes more and more trustworthy and reliable. So often when we say, I need to get peace, I need to get more equanimity, what we're really saying is, I don't want to be having this experience right now. Or this really hurts. This isn't what I want to happen right now. Or I'm afraid. There's fear present. So when we can be with that, with our whole hearts, clear-eyed, reality as it's shifting, and our reactions or responses to it, a great potential opens up for how we respond and how we act and how we serve one another. Right? That possibility can't be there if we're just reacting. Yeah. Meeting insult with insult, meeting blame with blame, meeting ill will with ill will, that possibility for deepening can't be there. So instead of trying to shut down any kind of reaction, or like Tuareg said, try to be in a dukkha-free zone where nothing can touch us, maybe we have to do that for a little while. Maybe we have to go fetal for a little while, and that's fair enough. But we don't have to stay there. We don't have to stay there. So may we each remember our true sources of refuge. May we open to dwelling in the gap between how we would like it and how it is. May we continually align ourselves with deepest forms of love and care, but also change. And may we be at peace together. May we be at peace. Really, really appreciate the chance to be together and appreciate the strength of your presence and practice. It's palpable, and our job is just to remind you to trust it. It's
Thank
we can
you.
feel.
So I'm making an assumption in this these reflections that everyone here is upset about the election results. And if there's someone who's not upset, there's a different kind of support is needed around this. But I'm just making that assumption that this is a very, disappointing, devastating, fearful time for us, and to speak to how we can use our practice to help support us in the midst of this. I have to first just call attention to the physiological effects that we have. Sometimes it's obvious, but when we're in the middle of it, we sometimes forget that perspective of the body's kind of hardwiring response to threat, to danger. That we you can imagine, you're taking a walk in the woods and a grizzly bear pops out, your heart's gonna race, eyes are gonna dilate, your muscles are gonna mobilize, digestion's going to slow down. You're going to try to run away from that bear, or you're going to try to fight the bear, or are you going to play dead? And this is part of our evolutionary advantage that allows us to get through danger. And then we had the election happened, and it's a different kind of danger. It's not this concrete thing we can see, this bear right in front of us, that we can feel its hot breath against our cheek. We can't feel like we've run away and escaped. It's like it's kind of looming around the corner. We don't know what it's going to be, and our minds, make new things of it. So we don't get a chance to really kind of decycle. We stay in this kind of heightened state of arousal, like maybe with that fear response, or maybe the anger response, the fighting, trying to find something to fight against. Or we could also freeze. We could also basically that playing dead when we shut things down. That has a sense of numbness, a sense of disconnection, of disbelief. And these are actually all very natural and at times very helpful responses to overwhelming threat and danger. And this situation is going to probably likely continue for the next, 4 years or so. We're going to have different levels of it. It's going to cycle different intensities and quiet down. But when we're really caught in that fear response or the flight response or the fight response or the freeze response, it's really hard to stay in balance. It's hard to find a place of connection to yourself that wise action can flow from. So I just want to acknowledge that and how we first kind of the first step is to try to start to downregulate, to find some kind of balance in our bodies. And meditation can be a very helpful part of that if it's done skillfully. But as I alluded to in the guided meditation, sometimes we tune into our bodies to meditate and we try to connect with the breath or the body sensations. And instead of calming us down, it actually amps us up. There's like this upwelling of emotion or fear. You can actually feel the physiological response of fight and flight start to kick in. Or we can feel the sense of disconnection, the sense of numbness. It's basically this unresolved quality of trauma in our system. And so just recognizing if that's happening, that there needs to be some adjustments, some modifications around the meditation, a turning toward something that's actually grounding in your moment's experience. Sometimes it's external, like sound can be helpful. Taking a couple of moments just to really check out, you know, the whole room slowly going from one end to another, saying, okay, there's no danger here. There's no presidential candidate sitting here in my room. You know, I can kind of calm the system down a little bit. That it's part of this deep wiring. It's okay. Is there any danger around? You know, finding an object of attention. Sometimes finding something that's pleasant, you know, finding a part of the body that you can actually relax into. And the reason to do this is not to avoid or discount the reality and the danger of situations, the intensity, the urgency of things, but to help you find a place of grounding and centeredness that you can actually find action to come from. Because once you start to find that balance, and we may have to keep falling and then we find it and then we lose it and we come back again, you have to be very patient with yourselves over these weeks and months and years together. Then we start to acknowledge, okay, what's the actual situation? You know, this is different than acceptance. It's not like we give up or say, okay, I'm going to just allow things to be how they are. It's really acknowledging this clear-eyed acknowledgement of what's present. If you think about like if there was a natural disaster, you know, like a tornado, an earthquake, forest fire, flood, it's devastating. Our whole lives get turned upside down. There's a lot of distress, there's a lot of grief, a lot of loss, maybe the loss of life, loss of things we hold dear. It's natural to feel reactions to that. It's natural to feel the loss and the anger and all of that. And if we stay in that place, we aren't very effective. We're not able to actually do anything. So at some point we need to, okay, how can I actually acknowledge this reality of this time period? And what's needed, what's actually effective. If you had a chance, haven't had a chance to listen to Kamala's concession speech, you know, it's very good that she speaks to this, that you know, there's a time to just roll up your sleeves and get to work, not to give up, not to surrender. And if as meditators, if we can learn to come from a grounded, centered place, the actions flow in a much more powerful, skillful way. One way to consider this is our sphere of influence, because the stage and the level of dynamic is so beyond most of our influence in our life. And we can often feel very helpless around that. But learning to step back and ground into our bodies and see, where is my sphere of influence? What is actually possible for me to do in this moment? You know, what can I do? Not from a helpless place, but actually a clear-headed place. There's a sutta called the Acrobat Sutta, where the Buddha is basically describing this very thing. If you look at two acrobats, one's the lower one, another one's up above being supported, and they're doing all the gymnastic stuff. But the lower one has his job is to help the person not fall, to help them stay upright, to keep them safe from falling, from danger. And the Buddha asked, well, how do you best do that? You know, does the person below just really focus on the person above? Or is it better for them to take care of their own grounding, their own sense of balance, their own sense of stability? And from that place, they're much more able to hold and support. You know, this is, I don't know which teacher first brought this forth by using the, you know, the safety, airline safety talk. Like when the air comes down, to take care of your own air first before you take care of the loved ones, the children and vulnerable ones around you. Because if you don't do that, you know, your pass out won't be very effective. So taking care of ourselves, to learning how to have that sense of spaciousness, of grounding, connecting with nature. You know, if you're here in the Seattle area, I know there's people from Bellingham and other places. But there's also been some beautiful times this time of year. I was talking with my wife about that there's been this beauty of the fall colors and the light and the sunlight. And don't let yourself really enjoy that, to connect with that. And this provides this ballast in these difficult times. You know, monitoring how much news we consume, you know, knowing enough to be informed, to take good action, but also realizing we can easily, in some ways, re-traumatize ourselves by hearing about all, we start to get amped up. Reading more things that are distressing is not going to necessarily, is unlikely to help us calm down. Now it's going to help us find that place of grounding that we can actually act from. You know, starting to connect with what's right in the moment, you know, connecting with things which are good in your surroundings, in your relationships, in your life. And this is not about denying or avoiding the difficulty and the reality and the very distressing things, but trying to regain your balance. Because we're all responsible for our minds. We're all responsible for how we relate to life. You know, this is not what we would have chosen. This is not what we hoped for. And yet, we still have to learn to take responsibility for our own reactions, our own experience. So part of it is really caring for the hurt, caring for the rage, the pain. And it's also learning to add to that as little as possible. And then from that point, once we start to have that quality of balance, that sense of grounding, then there's this movement into life, to be observant. How can I actually help those who are marginalized, those who are being attacked in our communities? And I was talking to my wife, and it's, you know, even after a day or so, she works in the school system, and, you know, some kids are talking to families or immigrant, you know, people from Mexico or South America, and just saying that they're going to get their parents are going to get deported. And that's a real fear for a lot of these kids, you know? So you have people who are kind of using this power, this misuse of power to cause harm. See the same thing with women and people saying it's your body, my choice, you know, this complete invalidations of people's autonomy. Of course, the attack on our, you know, beloved, you know, queer, gay, trans people, that there's this way that it's going to be hard for a lot of people. And so to be aware of that, to stand forward, if you do have any sense of privilege or power, to be willing to step forward and to offer assistance, whether it's within the Sangha or whether it's within the entire the communities that you live within. And if you happen to be someone who is more marginalized, getting support and help from the Sangha, finding those people who are willing to help, to see that this, what's been going down is not right. And finally, maybe one of the hardest things is this sense of divisiveness, the sense of separation, which is so strong in our country right now. That's hard. It's hard not to hate. It's hard not to make that sense of otherness. You know, it's hard for myself. I feel the rage. I feel the disbelief and the complete disconnection of worldviews. And yet that sense of division is not going to fix the problems in our world. It's not going to fix the problems in our country. It's not going to fix our division or our heart. So this is this koan, this spiritual question. How can we still have wise action? How can we be very clear in saying, no, that's not right? and yet not creating more division, not more separation. Somehow trying to find some common ground, some common reality. I just want to end with a quick poem that speaks to this first coming into this place of grounding in ourselves and from there going out into the world. It's called Clearing by Martha Postlewaite. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then you will know how to give yourself to this world so worth of rescue. All right, if you could just sit quietly for a couple of moments, letting those words settle.